From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we talk with the Genesee County Sheriff about his department's latest sting operation, 12 people arrested on child sex charges. Plus, a Michigan man's legal win means a big change to the law school admission test.
We've really had this enormous challenge for blind folks in this country who are suddenly being tested on their inability to draw pictures rather than on their aptitude for law.
County clerks weigh in on Wayne County's plan to provide tax relief for low-income homeowners who've fallen behind on their taxes.
We don't, however, want a system that creates an incentive for folks not to pay their tax bills.
Back to driver's training with a refresher course from the Michigan State Police. Stop tailgating.
We know for a fact in Michigan the number one cause of traffic crashes, especially in the Metro Detroit area, is following too closely.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The new plan announced last week by Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan and Wayne County Executive Warren Evans, the plan addressing the property tax foreclosure crisis, requires a change in the law, a change that some other county treasurers are not on board with. We'll find out why that is later in the hour. But first, a warning that what we're about to talk about will be somewhat graphic because it involves potential crimes against children. They showed up carrying money, alcohol, packages of condoms, even a gun, expecting to have sex with a 13-year-old girl. Instead, they were arrested, handcuffed, and arraigned on child sex charges. The Genesee County Sheriff's Department task force called GHOST has arrested 12 more suspects in its ongoing crackdown on child sex and human trafficking. This is in addition to the 22 people arrested 4 months ago. Genesee County Sheriff Robert Piquel is with us now. Sheriff, you wrote on Facebook that your task force was created under the build it and they will come philosophy. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I think everybody saw the movie Field of Dreams. And when I created this, I knew that this would work. It would be a program that will attract people that are perverse, the perverts. And, you know, they were thinking that it was going to be their field of dreams, a 13-year-old girl. And what it turned out to be was a nightmare for all 48 of them.
What are some of the details, the circumstances in these latest sting operation arrests that really, really jumped out at you?
Well, a couple of the things that are the variety of people that we get. You know, you said to me, you know, draw a profile of a child sex offender. You know, I had pictures in my mind of what it would be, but they come from all walks of life. We have bankers. We have the chief legal counsel for one of our biggest banks in the state of Michigan. We have managers of credit unions. We have laborers. We have investment bankers, and they come from all walks of life. But the one thing that they all have in common is there's an irresistible urge to have sex with a young girl or a young boy. I mean, we've arrested at least one person for wanting to have sex with a 13-year-old boy. But, you know, it's an irresistible urge, and I'll give you an example of what I mean. I went on television, local television, all of the news stations, about four or five news stations in our county, and I said to them, the next time you look into your computer and you think no one is watching, look again, because I may be at the other end and you may be looking at GHOST. Mm-hmm. During our latest operation, the one where we just arrested the second dozen, one of the defendants says in his text message, are you Piquel? Are you GHOST? But even suspecting that and knowing that it may well be, the irresistible urge to have sex with the young girl, he came and got arrested.
And there that happened. And you also talked about one man, and what did he do with his daughter before going to this rendezvous?
Yeah. He had a 13-year-old daughter himself, and he drove his 13-year-old girl, his own daughter, to volleyball practice, and the practice is usually an hour long. And while he was waiting for his daughter, rather than sitting and watching her practice, He drove to the motel to have sex with a 13-year-old girl. And, that's, it's hard to comprehend. One of the fellas, one guy came with nylons on. Another came with
he brought underwear, yeah. This is a fascinating thing, Sheriff, in the sense you've been in law enforcement for many years. You've been sheriff going on 20 years. Has it always been like this?
You know, I've never seen it like it is now. If it is, in my 21 years I've been the sheriff, I missed an awful lot because I'm thinking that, we all hear about pedophiles and one of the fellas that we arrested, and this is what really struck me. One of the people that we arrested was having sex with his own 2-year-old daughter. A female friend of his, it wasn't his girlfriend, but just a friend, a female friend. She was allowing him to have sex with her 6-year-old daughter. And that's what I talk, that's when I see to you that this perversion is so great. It's just hard to comprehend.
I imagine, Sheriff Pickell, you talk with other county sheriffs around Michigan, with state police, federal law enforcement. How big a problem is child sex crimes, child sex trafficking across our state? Is it worse or better in Genesee County than elsewhere?
There was a task force down in Detroit, and one of the federal agents that was a part of that task force once stated that people come to Flint, to carry out their perversion because there's no organized child mm-hmm. anti-sex trafficking. And so I thought to myself, that's right. We're all involved in our own thing. Like I've got programs for elder abuse and human trafficking. Nobody's doing anything about it. So I had my guys contact the Mesa, Arizona Police Department, and they're kind of the forerunners. And they have 20 people, 20 full-time staff people devoted to human trafficking. And we learned how to do it. We learned from them, how to go about it, how to set it up. And this is why we're so successful. I mean, but we work at it. And, if you don't work at it, you're not paying attention to it. You don't even know what's going on in your community because nobody wants to talk about it. You know, if you have a 13 or a 14-year-old girl and she becomes, do I want to subject my daughter to the publicity, going to court, testifying? These are the kind of problems we run into. We arrested two girls, young women that were part of human trafficking. We arrested the two guys. And we go to the preliminary exam, and the two women were totally afraid to testify. They wouldn't testify, and they were being given drugs and buying their food, And these two girls, they became so totally dependent on these two guys. And, they'd give them and that was the lure, the drugs. That's how they lured them into the prostitution, and they wouldn't testify. So it's really tough. It's a tough, tough area to be in. But the rewards are great. And I just went to a recent police chief's meeting, and I had my undersheriff. He stood up and offered 28 police agencies to come and join us, see how it's done. And one police agency came and spent some time with us. Hmm. Now, I don't know why, I mean, they're saying I don't have a problem in my area, but you don't know. We've arrested them from three counties, Lapeer, Oakland, Genesee, and Wayne. I'm sorry, four counties.
Okay, so they were coming from all over. And
they're coming from all over the county. They're coming from every, north, south, east, and west of our county. The problem, I don't understand it. It's a tough business to get involved in. And the people that work these cases for me, I mean, they're just, they're right down in the trenches dealing with these perverts. And one guy even said to me, Sheriff, you know, after a while you start to feel like a pervert yourself because, you know, you're carrying on conversations, you know, you're involved with them. He said, you don't feel good about yourself until you make the arrest, until you get them in custody.
That moment must be something.
Yeah.
Sheriff Pickhell, what would make your job easier to fight sex trafficking, you know, some kind of tool, something that you don't currently have?
Well, the one thing that we don't have is we don't have enough manpower. I have to take people out of other. I've got two full-time investigators working in human trafficking, but I've got to take people from my other divisions when we go out and do something. You got to have maybe 10 people there. You know, we get people that run, we get people that fighters. Number one, you need more money. And the county right now is talking about laying people off. And, you know, the first thing they say is, well, you know, we have mandated services and we got to, you know, give it to the mandated services. And so we need to get $500,000 from you. We need you to give us $3 million. Mm. I mean, those are people, those are bodies, and you take everything away from us. And not one, I don't know one politician that doesn't say I'm strong on crime and they get elected on a crime, you know, campaign. I'm going to stop crime. And then they get in and they vote against all the crime problems. Mm. It's, you know, all of the crime. Every time you get a budget, well, we got to cut. I'm sorry. But we need manpower. We need equipment. We need to get more training. You know, I got to get more people involved. You burn out quickly. These people that are working these cases, they burn out because, like I say, you're right down in the gutter with the perversion. And, you know, you can only do that for so long. And then you got to get them out and give them, you know, put them somewhere else and give them a break from it.
But bottom line, when you think of those young victims and what you're doing for them, that has to keep the effort going.
Oh, it does. I'll tell you what. I started an elder abuse program in 2008. You know, it was elders that were being neglected, abused, and exploited.
Yeah.
And we have thousands of warrants. And I did that because these are vulnerable people, the elderly.
So vulnerable, as are these youngsters that you're protecting through Ghost.
So that my human trafficking is really a spinoff of another vulnerable group, and that's the young kids, 13. And these young girls are so they're unsuspecting.
Sheriff Pickhell, we want to thank you so much for talking with us and sharing the work that you're doing with Ghost in Genesee County. Genesee County Sheriff Robert Pickhell, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you. Anytime. Bye now.
Much more to come right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you want to become a lawyer to go to law school, you have to take the Law School Admission Test, the LSAT. It is the primary standardized test that's used for law school admission decisions in the U.S. and Canada. But there are major changes coming to the LSAT, all because of a lawsuit that was filed by a Michigander, Angelo Bino. He is legally blind. He wants to go to law school, but his visual impairment prevents him from doing one key part of the test. So let's talk about how this suit was settled and what it will mean for future law school hopefuls. Angelo Bino, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. And we want to welcome Jason Turkish. He is Angelo's attorney. Jason, welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
Good to have you here. So talk about the long and winding road. This settlement is capping 8 years of litigation against the American Bar Association and also the folks who administer the LSAT, and that's the Law School Admission Council. So, Angelo, here you are. You managed to get the whole LSAT changed for the entire nation. How does it feel to be a trailblazer?
Feels great. You know, from the beginning, this was never about me. I wanted it to be about everyone in the country, blind people, disabled people. I want a whole generation of disabled and blind attorneys because the field is lacking. We need more blind and disabled attorneys to fight for civil rights and fight for our democracy.
So take us back to how this started for you.
Well, I wanted to go to law school, and I took the LSAT twice. And it was a horrible experience for me because no matter what I did to prep, no matter how much I studied, I walked in knowing that I was going to fail because one of the parts requires you to draw diagrams, and I can't draw diagrams. I was handed a pen and a piece of paper and told I could draw diagrams to answer the questions. I can't draw them because I can't see that well. So I guessed, hoping I would pass on that section, and passed the LSAT to go to law school. But unfortunately, twice I failed.
Okay, and this is the section called the logic game. So I'm going to read everybody an example of what we're talking about. Here is the problem. A, B, C, D, and E go into a bar, and E is next to A, and A is next to B, and C must be two spaces over from E. Where is D? Okay, my brain just melted reading that, Jason. What is the point of that in the law school admission test?
Well, the stated point of that is to test analytical reasoning skills. Lawyers must be analytical, and we certainly respect that. But for Angelo and for other blind applicants, it's testing something totally different. It's testing their ability to memorize the entire question, commit it in their head, and somehow solve it without the very space in the diagram that's provided to draw that. And that's a tall order.
Now, Jason, I know you are visually impaired. Michigan Supreme Court Justice Richard Bernstein is visually impaired. So how did the two of you manage the LSAT?
Well, for decades up until the mid-1990s, it was understood that blind law school applicants wouldn't even take this exam, that it was totally inappropriate, totally inaccessible.
Part of the exam. That,
well, actually, they were granted waivers on the entire exam because there wasn't a substitute section, if you will, which this case will lead to a new section on that exam. In my case, I have some functional vision. So for me, the logic games were a great difficulty, but not a total roadblock.
You did all right. You passed and you got into law school.
I got into law school and I'm here today.
In fact, am I correct that Justice Bernstein was the last person to get that waiver back in 1997?
That's our understanding, which is really remarkable. So for the last quarter century, we've really had this enormous challenge for blind folks in this country who are suddenly being tested on their inability to draw pictures rather than on their aptitude for law.
Jason, I know this case actually began when Richard Bernstein, before he became a justice, sued the American Bar Association. You also sued the Admission Council.
Correct.
Is this all part of that effort, and what happened to those efforts?
Well, so this case has gone on for a long time, and I got to commend Angelo on his perseverance because he has really hung in there. This case has been litigated in one form or another for over 8 years. Justice Bernstein initially represented Angelo in 2011 and sued the American Bar Association. That case alleged that if you are requiring U.S. law schools to administer this test and not giving them the opportunity to waive it, then you are, quote, offering it within the meaning of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which makes it very clear that it's illegal to offer a discriminatory exam. I joined as co-counsel in that case when I started practicing law 7 years ago. And when Justice Bernstein was elected to the Michigan Supreme Court, I was really proud to take it over and represent Angelo the last 7 years.
And now the plane has landed, and it landed successfully. So explain to us, Angelo, what happens now that this settlement has been reached?
Well, first of all, we thank the LSAC for doing the right thing, and we are hoping within the next 4 years that they can draw up a better test that better tests blind people's skills.
That analytical reasoning. And I was reading the statement, it's 48 months they have to do that.
Unfortunately, it's a long road. And that's why I mentioned admiring Angelo's perseverance, because from the ABA suit to litigating against the Law School Admission Council to getting these changes made, Angelo is looking at every bit of a decade. And it's incredible to keep with it this long. I'm so proud of him and everything he's accomplished. But what he's accomplished is no small feat. We are going to have a new examination. What the LSAC has committed to publicly in our statement is that there will be an opportunity for everybody in this country, blind folks, people suffering from other disabilities who have challenges with this section, literally everybody will be able to take an exam that does not have the current logic games. And that's going to open incredible opportunities. And the reason that's so important is because it's going to be Angelo who's going to take on the next great challenge for people with disabilities. That's who's willing to step up and fight these battles. And that's why it's so important to ensure that, as Angelo so artfully said, the next generation of civil rights lawyers.
And the other thing I noticed as I was kind of reviewing, I was reading Above the Law, and it noted that the law school admission test will also be completely digital.
Correct.
Is that all part of this? And what does that mean?
So that wasn't part of this case, but the LSAT is really going through a period of change, as is standardized testing across the country. We see articles out every week about changes to standardized testing, questions about what its really value is and what its purpose is, and whether it's actually achieving that or whether where in some cases like this, it's shutting qualified applicants out of the process.
Well, indeed. Aren't some top-tier law schools actually saying, you know what, we don't need the LSAT. We'll take the GMAT graduate.
The GMAT or the GRE. No, law schools are absolutely reassessing this test, as they should. You know, we should always be asking the question, are we actually administering an exam that is helping us admit qualified applicants, especially for law school, because law school is what feeds not just future lawyers, but judges. The majority of our members of Congress have law degrees, hold law degrees. So when you have a discriminatory process that's picking who goes to law school, you're also shutting the door to people for leadership positions throughout the entire country.
So, Angelo, you're going to have to still wait a while to be able to take this test. I mean, you can't. They're not going to let you take it with that piece missing. They have to develop a new piece. Do you want to be part of that process?
Absolutely. Part of our agreement is that we would give input on the new test, and I'm looking forward to doing that.
Yes, I understand you're going to be working with Wayne State University Law School's Disability Law Clinic?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, so what will that look like? Do you have ideas of how this is going to be able to be enacted in order to be a fairer law school admission test?
Well, I think people should be tested on the skills that are required to, you know, be successful in law school and in your legal career. I don't know any attorney that has to sit and draw diagrams.
What has this, Angelo, taught you, this whole experience, all these years, about the legal system and about being a lawyer?
Well, legal system, you know, can move slow at times, but it's fair. There's not a profession that I could see myself in other than being a lawyer. Because I will say this, there is an assault against our democracy, against our civil rights, and against our immigrant communities. And there's no important time in this country's history where we require more trial lawyers than now.
And let me ask you, as someone who is an attorney, Jason Turkish, what has this prospective lawyer, what is he going to be bringing to the profession?
Well, he's going to be likely the only person in his law school class who has won their first case before the first day of law school. So he's going to have a leg up on the competition, but he's going to bring a perspective. And it's so important that lawyers represent society, that they represent the diverse nature of society. And that means people with disabilities. We're all, sadly, one car accident, one illness, one diagnosis away from that term. And having an accessible world, an accessible built environment, accessible policies are so important. And having lawyers with the perspective to understand the importance of that means more now than ever.
So it's the culmination, this amicable resolution of Binno versus the Law School Admission Council, the LSAC, and the result is a complete change. And how many people might this affect, having this reform of the LSAT?
Well, we know that 130,000 people a year take the LSAT. The real question is, how many blind people have wanted to go to law school but have felt completely shut out by the current exam? How many people have studied for the test and just said, there's no way I can do this? This is never going to accurately represent my ability, so unfortunately, I can't proceed. And I'm really excited to see how the numbers of blind applicants shoot up after these changes go into effect.
And then, I guess, walk us through, as you look ahead to the law school experience. In fact, when Justice Bernstein was here, he described the work he had to do and the work he does to this very day to prepare for cases for the Michigan Supreme Court, extra prep time and having cases read to him. But are there changes that you think could happen in the process of going through law school and also taking the bar exam that need to happen?
Well, what I would say is the reason I'm really excited about this settlement is because I believe, and obviously I'm biased being legally blind, but I think blind people make great lawyers. The type of difficulties you have to overcome as somebody who's blind lead you to be a very effective advocate for your client. As you just mentioned, Justice Bernstein talks publicly about the extra preparation he has to do. When I go to court, I can't use written notes effectively. So I commit my entire argument to memory. I have to know the case law that much better than my opponent. It makes me quicker on my feet. It makes me better. And so being able to have blind people apply fairly to law schools is truly a wonderful thing, because law is such a great career for blind individuals.
Well, congratulations on this successful settlement and the changes that are being hailed in the law school admission test that'll be happening from coast to coast. You still have to wait another 4 years?
Hopefully less than that.
Hopefully
but
less.
I'm committed to the end.
They've started the work now. It's a deadline. We hope it's done sooner. They've also agreed to some interim accommodations with Angelo and with all blind individuals to try to bridge the gap between now. I'm also hopeful that this case and the publicity it's had will make law schools sensitive to blind applicants. So even if the changes haven't been fully complete, hopefully this sends a signal that this test is not currently fair and law schools will choose to do the right thing. I know any law school should be very proud to have Angelo.
Attorney Jason Turkish and his client, Angelo Binno, whose suit against the Law School Admission Council resulted in a major change in what the law school admission test is going to look like in the future. Thank you to both of you for being with us.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
This superb One Direction highway is engineered for easy grades and for speed with safety. The echoes of that two-cylinder motor have never died, and they never will.
Call the turn signal! You've learned to drive!
Michigan's traffic deaths are up 2% this year, so it seems to be an apt time to review some of Michigan's ignored or forgotten rules of the road. To help us through that, we welcome Lieutenant Michael Shaw, the Michigan State Police. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
So let's talk about tailgating. So when you drive behind a vehicle, how close is too close?
So if we remember all the way back to driver's ed time, they always told you, you know, one vehicle length for every 10 miles that you're going down there. Again, you know, you want to be close enough that you can stop in a sure clear distance is what it's called. And we've all seen it. People drive down the freeway, traffic jams on the brake, and you see everybody dart off onto the shoulder. Those people were all too close to the car in front of them. We know for a fact in Michigan, the number one cause of traffic crashes, especially in the Metro Detroit area, is following too closely. Because again, as we talked about some of the other segments before, people don't want to leave that space in there where somebody can get in front of them. They all think that the race is on to get to wherever they're going. And if I leave somebody in there, somebody will get in front of me.
And they do, because I try to leave that gap when I'm going on the freeway. And invariably, somebody goes, oh, good for me, I'm going in there. So then you've got somebody who's just cut in front of you.
So then all you do is just back off a little further off that person. And it's always hard. You're always like, oh, that guy just cut me off. I can't believe that happened to me. But somebody's got to be the bigger person. And that's what I always say. So you just kind of back off through there. That way you kind of increase that distance. Because what's going to happen is the person that cut you off is the one that you're going to pass by on the shoulder eventually that rear-ended the vehicle in front of them and has got a ticket in their future and higher insurance rates, and you're still continuing on your way. So you kind of, in a secret way, you won that discussion anyways, because they're the ones that are going to be stuck over there.
Well, let me ask you this, Lieutenant. What is the best way, if I'm being tailgated and I see somebody right there on my backside, what is the best way for me to handle that, particularly on a freeway?
So unfortunately, in today's time and days, the secret handshake of, you know, the middle finger and stuff like that, you never know what people are thinking anymore at this time. So my first suggestion is, if you can get over a lane either way, left or right, just get out of the way and let them go. I mean, if they're in that much of a hurry to do that, if it gets bad enough where you think that they're actually aggressively dealing with you or aggressively getting to the road rage portion of it, get off the freeway if you can. Or, you know, make a right turn if you're on the private street. Drive into a public parking lot and give us a call. If you call 911 and we're close enough to, you know, and actually there's not a trooper on every corner, but if we're close enough to get there, we're going to try to get a hold of that person, because we've kind of seen, and tying this to some of the shootings that we've had in Metro Detroit on the freeway, these are, a majority of them have been CPL holders that, you know, have been through the process, and, you know, one thing just ticked them off and the gun was there and they pointed it at somebody. Let us know that. We want to get these people off the street. That's somebody that, you know, if you can't handle just a simple little task like driving, that's somebody that we need to have a discussion for. So don't engage them. Don't make eye contact. Whatever you do, don't jam on the brakes. We know a lot of people do the brake checking because, you know, if you end up getting into a crash afterwards, even though they're following too closely, you don't know what kind of altercation is going to follow up there. None of this is worth getting hurt over. Just let them go.
Lieutenant Mike Shaw, Michigan State Police, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We began our Learn to Drive segment last month, and we have been blown away by your response. We've gotten so many emails from those of you who want to hear your driving pet peeves sorted out on the air with Lieutenant Shaw. If you send us an email, thank you. We'll likely be talking about your suggestion soon. In the meantime, which rules of the road do you wish other drivers would know about? Let us know. You can email us at stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up on Stateside, with both medical and recreational cannabis now legal in Michigan, what's the difference?
If you think about it, the adult use market is for 21 years and older. If anyone has a medical ailment, they're under 21. The medical program is still of use to that population.
Weeding through Michigan's growing cannabis industry. That comes up after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Low-income homeowners in Detroit and Wayne County could get help in delinquent property taxes through a plan called Pay As You Stay. As described to us by Wayne County Executive Warren Evans last week, this plan allows county treasurers to significantly reduce the back taxes owed by homeowners who qualify for a state-mandated property exemption.
I'm not going to miss the revenue when compared to having more stable neighborhoods and more people being able to avoid foreclosure with their homes.
Now, if it works, thousands of Wayne County homeowners who face foreclosure could keep their homes. But for this plan to happen, the state legislature must approve, and not everybody's on board with the plan.
The sense is from those who have been involved with that, yeah, there are a number of treasurers that see value in this and think it will be good, and there are some others that probably are opposed, or at least at this point don't know enough about it to be in agreement. But, you know, there's certainly ways to do that. And, you know, one of them is to, you know, make it applicable to counties above a certain population or in a certain geographic area. It doesn't have to be a wholesale thing for the entire state. And we certainly don't want to force anything on people that don't want it. But it's certainly something that would be beneficial here.
Well, let's get the view from the west side of Michigan as we turn to Kalamazoo County Treasurer Mary Balcoma, who's also co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Michigan Association of County Treasurers. So, Mary, what do you think of Pay As You Stay?
Well, currently there is remedy under the law to get a poverty exemption. It's MCL, Michigan Compiled Law, 211.7U. So I know the Mayor Duggan is sending out 188,000 pieces of mail that will instruct people on how to get the poverty exemption, and that will be for the year 2019. So what we really need, in addition to his legislation, is a fix in the law to allow the poverty exemption to go back a year. So some folks forget to fill it out, don't know it's available, and they really qualify. So that would give additional relief.
But what about that plan?
You know, I was looking at the Step Forward Michigan data, and in Wayne County, $110 million has been given to homeowners for back mortgage payments, back tax payments, and back condo payments. And some of those folks, after their taxes and payments were 100% caught up, they are back with delinquent taxes. I think the Step Forward numbers, the $110 million that went to people in Wayne County over the last 3 years, a number of those people are in tax foreclosure all over again. I think people do not change their behavior quickly enough to get out of debt and poverty and tax foreclosure. So I think it's really important for folks to get on a payment plan and pay their taxes every single month. However, there's thousands that have not. And so I think this legislation should be specific to Wayne County, or it should be geographically specific. There's a lot of pushback from smaller counties that this should be not mandated, but it should be an option. If it's not county or population specific, we could have this plan in our county, or we could not.
So, which certainly from that clip we heard with Wayne County Executive Warren Evans, it seems like he's certainly open to that. He said that, you know, we don't want to force anything on people that don't want it. What are your concerns about the structure of this pay-as-you-stay plan?
A few things. Our number one goal as county treasurers is to keep people in their homes. We don't, however, want a system that creates an incentive for folks not to pay their tax bills. So if you're not paying your tax bill and this would be something that could happen, we want that to be the exception, and it really needs to be needs-based. But currently, there is remedy under the law, so maybe we need to get more information out to people to get the poverty exemption. And to be eligible for the poverty exemption, you have to live in your home, and we need to know that you're in poverty, so you should have your tax return done. We give free tax preparation assistance in Kalamazoo. Seniors and certain disabled homeowners can ask for a deferment. So you can ask for a deferment on your bill if you are, you know, in poverty. That's currently under the law. Disabled veterans can get a complete 100% exemption. So that's currently. You can get a property tax credit on your Michigan income taxes. So that is currently under the law. And if your assessment's too high, you can appeal the value at the March Board of Review. So we really want folks to take advantage of all of that.
So am I hearing you say, you know what, there's a lot of help that's already on the books in the law, that maybe this particular bill isn't needed?
Well, I think it goes a little bit too far because once the taxes are turned over to the Wayne County Treasurer, he writes a check to all those taxing jurisdictions to make them whole so they can operate. So let's say he shells out $50 million. Well, he's borrowing money to do that, and then he's going to collect from the delinquent taxpayers with interest. So if he reduces all of that interest, he still has to pay back those delinquent tax anticipation notes, and now he's not going to have money to do that. So I'm not a huge fan, but I agree there needs to be some remedy just with the volume in Wayne County.
So would county treasurers oppose any kind of bill along this line, or could you see a way to support it with changes? And if so, what kind of changes?
Yes, we could support it with changes. First, with a geographic limit, so or a population limit. Second, to have the poverty exemption have a one-year look back. So you would get it for 19, and if you missed 18 and you really deserved it, you would get it for 18 as well. So we want the poverty exemption to have a look back, and if you're 100% disabled veterans, you have to get it for the current year. You have to apply every year, and some folks miss it. And so then they get the full tax bill. We would like a look-back period on the veterans exemption as well.
And population, what about population?
Yeah, maybe to a certain population, 750,000 counties above or a million. So we would like to put a population cap in there and then add those two more things, and we'll get that to the legislature, and then it's way more palatable.
We've been talking for years about this problem of foreclosures in Wayne County and in Detroit.
Yes.
Can you give us a sense of property tax foreclosures in other parts of the state? I guess I'm wondering, is this on the radar? Is it a concern for other county treasurers the way it is for Detroit and for Wayne County?
Certainly the number of foreclosures have been going down since the 2008 housing crisis, but the numbers in Wayne County totally match all of the foreclosures in the rest of the state. So the magnitude is very, very large. The Detroit Land Bank owns more parcels than the complete parcel count in Kalamazoo County, just to give you a comparison. They own 100,000 parcels. We have totally in our whole county with 270,000 people, you know, 100,000 parcels. So the magnitude is great.
We have been talking with Kalamazoo County Treasurer Mary Balcoma, who's also co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Michigan Association of County Treasurers. I want to thank you for spending time with us on Stateside, Mary.
Thank you so much.
It's been nearly a year since Michigan voters said yes to recreational marijuana, and now things are moving ahead to bring recreational marijuana businesses to communities that want them. Starting November 1st, the state's Marijuana Regulatory Agency, the MRA, will start accepting applications for recreational pot businesses. So we wondered how introducing recreational pot and the stores and shops that will open to serve that market would affect the existing medical marijuana industry in Michigan. So we're going to turn to Lisa Conine, who's with Ohm of Medicine. It's a medical marijuana dispensary in Ann Arbor that opened in 2010. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So is Ohm of Medicine going to pursue a recreational pot license?
Yeah, most definitely. And so you'll see pretty much every dispensary, medical provisioning center do the same. The way that the law is written is it allows for those medical facilities to be the ones to get priority for those licenses in the first 2 years. I believe that that was out of the motivation to help with the implementation process, speed up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So every state that's passed adult use takes at least a year to get the program up and running. So I think that that was written in by, you know, the advocates who created the bill to help speed up that process. So yes.
What kind of questions are you getting from the public?
Yeah, so we get calls every day, first of all, asking if we can serve to the general population, and then when will those sales begin, and then what will happen to the medical program. So first off, as you stated, the licenses, the applications will be available November 1st. So we expect hopefully early January to see places start licensed and being able to serve the general population. And then in terms of the medical program, we still tell our patients that if they obtain their card and keep their card, there is some perks there. So there will be a less tax structure, so less amount of tax that they'll have to pay at the register, being in the medical program versus the tax structure for adult use sales. And then also we anticipate that they'll see shorter lines, wait times, and more attention on them. We see a lot of patients that use it just for medical reasons and medical reasons only. They don't necessarily want to be associated with people using it for any other reason. So they want that specialized care. And so there is a perk to having the medical card and still getting that attention. But it's not going to necessarily do away with the program at all. It keeps the medical program intact. They're two separate programs that will work, you know, synergistically together.
Do you see yourself opening a separate facility so the folks of the recreational mindset can be one place and the folks who are seeking, you know, medical marijuana for medical issues could be in a separate place?
So the way that it's written, there's no requirements that it has to be a separate facility. It just has to be separate, like registers and indicated and people served separately. So for our standpoint, in my personal view is that I think it's more beneficial when they are together because, again, my personal view is that all use is medical. We do have something called the endocannabinoid system. So if you're using cannabis, it is impacting your body in a medicinal way, even if your intention is for recreational use. So having those two uses coincide under one roof, I think will just better educate people and normalize it all around.
And there are people listening to us who have never tried marijuana and would be are marijuana curious.
For sure.
And to that point,
canna curious.
There you go. Is there any difference between marijuana that is medical and marijuana that's recreational?
So not necessarily. I think that the difference is your intention behind it. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about the logistics, the cannabis that will be coming through the medical program and then also into the adult use market, at the beginning will be coming from probably the same suppliers because those are the ones that are already up and running and have product available. We can anticipate probably some product shortages once the program launches. This happens in every state that launches this type of program as well.
Pent-up demand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then as time goes on, we'll see the market diversify and more people enter and hopefully some more craft producers that maybe were from the caregiver market that were pushed out due to high licensing fees for the medical program can now have an opportunity to enter the adult use market with a lot lower licensing fees and less capital requirements.
There has been a lot of concern, Lisa, the headlines about vaping and particularly deaths related to vaping THC. What is Ohm of Medicine doing to make sure the product is safe?
Yeah, well, first I want to clarify, the deaths are not because of vaping THC. They're from vaping any additives that are put into that. So I just want to clarify, mm-hmm. we're not demonizing THC or mm-hmm. people who use it. And I think that that is a very important case for the need for regulation and mm-hmm. for the need for legalization so we can keep people safe. When we have a tracked system, we know where things are coming and what's in
in it. But for us personally, we've done our due diligence, contacting all of our vendors, making sure that they don't use those ingredients that are suspected to be the problem. There's still a lot that we don't know. But then we also just tell our patients that, you know, vaping has only been around for 10-ish years. Smoking the cannabis flower has been around for 5,000-ish years. So maybe go with the data there that we have.
As far as getting a medical marijuana card, it sounds like it's still worth doing because you were saying there's perks for the folks that have those cards, including lower taxes.
For sure. Yeah. And even for, if you think about it, the adult use market is for 21 years and older. If anyone has a medical ailment, they're under 21, the medical program is still of use to the to that population.
Ohm of Medicine has been partnering with the University of Michigan in assessing the experience of medical marijuana users. Tell us about this study. What are the questions and what are you learning?
Yeah, so this is our third IRB-approved study that we've done with the University of Michigan. This one essentially is surveying people's experiences with cannabis, their daily regimen, including dosing, their knowledge on the products that they're using, and then their relationship with their healthcare team. So we see a lot of people coming in, and they tell us that they're not able to talk to their doctors about this. That's a huge problem. So we want to pull some data points from what we gather and hope to reach out to the medical community even more and also influence policy with those data sets, but also to just push the need for more research. We hear all the time from policymakers and from medical professionals that, oh, well, there's just not enough research. So we're rolling up our sleeves and trying to collect that data. We have information coming into our doors every single day. So we're just trying to gather that.
What are the most important questions that this research should be addressing?
I would say the knowledge that people have or the lack thereof, and how can we address that? How can our policies match what people actually need in terms of having the comfortability and the confidence to talk to their healthcare team about it without fear of penalty or without the doctors having fear of penalty?
Certainly that reference to pent-up demand on the recreational market is very true. In fact, the day after marijuana was legalized by Michigan voters, our stateside producers were calling around and we called some medical dispensary and he just picked up the phone and said, no, we can't sell it to you. Immediately, people wanted to come in and buy.
Yeah.
So there's certainly in the public who've been waiting for this to come a lot of anticipation. What are you most excited about as recreational marijuana moves forward?
Yeah, I am so excited to see this normalized, to finally see some of the shame taken out of cannabis use, for people to use cannabis and feel comfortable doing that without the shame or penalty. And then also for people, like we were saying, are kind of curious to come and give it a shot and not fear the stigma or, again, the like law penalty that might be associated with that use. I think something that's really exciting is not only is adult use moving forward, but the state rules also allow for social use consumption spaces. So if municipalities allow for that, which Ann Arbor did just pass the ordinance last week, there will be designated consumption spaces where people can actually consume in public. And what better way to normalize this, something that people have been using for thousands of years, than to have it be done in a communal way where you can learn about cannabis and do fun events like maybe comedy shows or yoga and just really start to normalize it.
How do you address those who are listening to us? Undoubtedly, you know they're there, who think this is a horrible idea for Michigan, worried about people driving while high. How are we going to keep the roads safe? What about unknown health effects or addiction issues? There's people who, and they don't want shops in their communities. How do you address those folks?
Yeah, well, first I would just say that it's totally understandable to have fear. This is something that has been prohibited in our culture for such a long time, and we've been told a lot of lies and fear-based narratives around this plant. And so I would say if you have fear about this, then to actually engage and talk to your policymakers about it, because, again, the reason why we don't know a lot about this plant is because it's been prohibited and we haven't been able to research it in the way that we should to have that data, to keep us all safe. So if you're frustrated and worried, then call up your senator and tell them that we need more research on cannabis. Let's deschedule cannabis from a Schedule 1 status so we can actually understand it in the way that we need to fully utilize it and keep us all safe.
Lisa Conine with Ohm of Medicine, a medical marijuana dispensary in Ann Arbor. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening to Stateside.